So, you know how I told you that I zapped the absolute shit out of myself with the static grass applicator? So I didn't really, I forgot they have a capacitor in them that you need to decharge.
Mm-hmm.
And it was literally the wire that connects from the applicator to the, you know, the mesh to create the static. That had shifted out of place because it moved. And I was just saying, oh, okay, I'll just grab my tweezers just so I could push the wire back in. I thought, no, it's all insulated. It'll all be fine. Until there was that one little bit of the wire that wasn't properly insulated.
Oh.
Next thing I know, it's like I got this sudden, like, punch in the chest, flung back, and then, like, a second later, it, like, zapped through my hand.
Yeah.
And I was like, I was sitting going, it took me like a good minute to realize what the fuck I'd just done to myself. I was like, what the hell was that? Oh, it was the applicator. And then my right hand had like pins and needles for like an hour or so afterwards.
Yeah, you should always take the ground wire and touch the screen. But if the wire came disconnected from the screen, then...
It couldn't decharge itself, so fucking, yeah. But now I know, but yeah, it was, yeah, it took me a while. I'm sitting there like, what the hell was that? I didn't know AA batteries had that much bloody charge in them.
It's because they got a negative ion generator in there that takes it up to like 6,000 kilovolts or something like that.
Mm. Yeah, it felt like, it felt like one of the electric fences I've had to deal with at work. You know, that's how I found out just the legal limit you can have for voltage on a cattle fence. I was at work, didn't even know it was an electric fence. Didn't have any of the signs. Usually, you can tell when the electric fence has been installed versus when it's just a wire and post.
Yeah,
I didn't know it was electric. Top wire, leaned down on it with my chest across the wire, trying to reach something I dropped, like a bit, like a tool or something, dropped it over, leant down, chest on the wire, because I thought it was all good. Next thing I know, I'm flung backwards, thinking I'm having the world's biggest heart attack. My coworker's sitting there going, what the fuck, are you okay? I was like, electric fence, FYI. Fuck. I had a red line across my chest from it. Fuck. And I was like, yep, that's, I think we just found the legal limit you can have for those puppies. Jesus. And it's pretty damn high.
I know, like, here in the States, it's like, at least when it goes for new installs.
Yeah.
And that probably also new professional installs, and just not some guy putting one up. But it's supposed to be, if it's not marked with a sign, it's still, the strap is supposed to be yellow to let you know it's voltage.
Hmm. Yeah. But, hmm. Good times, good times. The number of times I've fried myself on things. People wonder why I just have that little bit of extra caution with electricity. That's like, because I know how it feels.
You could be like that guy on YouTube that purposely shocks the piss out of himself just to show, you know, like, what would happen.
Yeah, I don't think I could ever, like, do that on purpose, eh? That shit hurts too much.
Yeah. Hey, you know, some people's into that stuff.
Some pay extra. All right, we'll get into the episode. So, welcome to the Micro Machines podcast. This year, our first official one for 2025 is a bit of a weird episode. Truth be told, we've had a bit of a cursed start of the year for the podcast. We've just had a whole lot of stuff in the way. You know, stuff for Garrison, stuff for me, stuff for Clint, stuff for everyone. It's just been a bit hectic, but we finally managed to find a spare hour or so to sit down, just me and Clint, to talk about the B-24 Liberator. It's going to be a short episode this week. It's just going to be no works in progress, no hobby news, no none of the fluff at the end. It's just going to be about building the B-24 Liberator and all the variants you can build. So that's all we're going to be talking about. But first off, for introductions, you have me, Callum, from New Zealand, currently sweating my absolute bollocks off because it's about 30 degrees Celsius in my room right now. It's great fun at the moment. nice little heat wave coming through.
And you have me, Clint, in Indiana, who is currently freezing because it is 20 degrees Fahrenheit outside.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
It's although, not.
Truth be told, I'd much rather be like too hot than too cold. I don't like the cold.
I've always thought of the opposite way, because you can always put more clothes on, but you can only take so many off before they arrest you.
Well, until things get interesting.
No, that's
it. It's only illegal if they catch you.
Exactly.
You know, it's like my favorite is in the airports when they say, "Have you ever been convicted of something?" It's like, "Convicted? No."
Yep.
All right. So this week we're going to be talking about the Consolidated B-24 Liberator, one of the better heavy bombers of World War II. It's often this sort of thing of B-17 versus B-24. What's better? Which one functions the best? As much as I like the B-17, I do have to admit the B-24 is the better bomber in a lot of cases, which we're going to find out about. So let's get on with the initial specifications. Of course, we are looking at the proto, an early type right here. So the Liberator's origins trace back to a 1938 request from the United States Army Air Corps, or the USAAC, for consolidated or constellated, whatever one you want, I pronounce it consolidated, to produce the B-17 under license. After a visit by company executives, including President Reuben Fleet, to the Boeing factory in Seattle, Washington, Consolidated decided to submit a more advanced design of its own. Basically, they were being a bit shady about the B-17 and said, "We can do better."
Yes.
And they, you know, did. This new design, the Model 32, combined the wing created by designer David R. Davis, featuring also, hence why it's called the Davis Wing, featuring a high-efficiency airfoil design developed through unconventional methods with the twin tail concept from Consolidated Model 31 flying boat. These elements were incorporated into a fresh fuselage, intentionally designed to accommodate two bomb bays, each matching the size and capacity of the B-17's bomb bays. Just to throw extra shade, the Liberator could carry twice the load of a B-17. The B-17 could carry barely anything, to be honest. I think at most 8 1,000-pound bombs, which is one of the reasons why I haven't watched Masters of Air, because there are so many inaccuracies, I cannot watch it. Wait, have you seen it?
I still haven't watched it yet either.
I've
just
seen
it's on Apple, and I know don't have Apple anything.
Yeah, I've seen enough scenes in the air battles to know I won't enjoy it just because I'll be taken out. Like there's one scene where they're bombing, and literally a stream of like 30 bombs come out of a B-17. I'm like, they only ever carried 8 to 12. Not that
oh
many.
My God.
It's like, you look at it, it's like, where the fuck were those stored?
Along kind of like the same lines, I'll just interrupt you here for a minute.
Yeah,
I've recently watched an episode of Mysteries at the Museum, which, you know, it's an older TV show. But they was talking about a World War One scene between the British and the Germans. Well, the British were wearing, you know, World War One uniforms. The Germans, though, was in World War Two uniforms, and both sides had M1 Garands.
Oh,
yeah. So yeah, very inaccurate. It was very hard to watch.
When they get to like that point, it's like, I don't care what the story's like. Yeah, take you 5 minutes to find that out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also in like Masters of the Air, they had like the 50 cals were firing the ground M2 Browning fire rate of like 600 to 650, as opposed to the aircraft AN-M2, which had about 1,100 rounds a second, rounds
blaze.
A minute. Yeah, so it's like they got that wrong, which is an easy thing. I mean, it's all fucking dubbed anyway, so. Mm-hmm. But then also they had this big thing about making sure when a B-17 was being shot down, you know, to make sure that the bombardier drew out his 45 and shot up the Norden bomb site, you know, to make sure it's destroyed so the Germans didn't capture it. You know, completely forgetting the fact that it's about to plummet at about 350 knots straight down into the ground, nose first. And also the Germans already had the Norden bomb site. And they didn't care to use it because they didn't do that sort of high-level bombing. They were perfectly fine with the bomb sites they had. So, you know, it was one of those exaggerations about you know, the Norden bomb site and keeping it a secret from the Germans. The Germans knew about it. They just didn't care. It wasn't their thing.
Isn't this another thing with Tom Hanks?
I think so.
As an executive producer? I mean, he's usually strives for accuracy.
Yeah, I've just noticed a few times now when you have like someone who, like Tom Hanks, who goes for accuracy, but they become a producer, but they're like, then you find out they're just like producer in name.
Oh, you know? Okay.
Yeah, but yeah, there's just a lot of, yeah, just enough of it where I'm like, no, this is total bullshit, realms of fantasy, can't watch it anymore, even though it might be a good story. we could totally do an episode just about inaccurate movies and films.
We should do that one day.
When we're drunk.
Even better. Hey, IPMS 2026, the Nationals.
Hey, I'm saving up already, man. I've got $300 in the account for that.
Fucking A.
All right. Back to the B-24, though. So, a little tangent. In January 1939, the USAAC, under specification C-212, formally invited Consolidated to submit a design study for a bomber with a longer range, higher speed, and greater ceiling than the B-17. It's just fucking throwing shades at Boeing right now. The specification was structured in a way that the Model 32 was poised to be the automatic winner. This program was part of the broader Project A, an Air Corps initiative from the mid-1930s aimed at developing an intercontinental bomber. While the B-24 did not fully meet the goals of Project A, it marked a step in that direction, eventually contributing to the development of the Boeing B-29 and Consolidated's own B-32 and B-36. So the design, and here we have in the top left, that is the prototype right there. It's a very early looking
B-24. It's a very early looking one.
So, in March 1939, the U.S. Army Air Corps awarded Consolidated a contract for a prototype XB-24, with the requirement that one example be ready by the end of the year. The company completed the prototype just 2 days before 1939 ended, making its first flight a remarkable achievement. The design was simple but advanced for its time, incorporating innovative features such as tricycle landing gear and the efficient Davis wings. Both would influence future aircraft designs. Compared to the B-17, the Model 32 features a shorter fuselage, 25% less wing area, but a 6-foot longer wingspan and substantially larger carrying capacity. It also boasted a distinctive twin tail, setting it apart visually from its predecessors. While the B-17 relied on 9-cylinder Wright 1820 Cyclone engines, the Model 32 was powered by twin-row 14-cylinder Pratt & Whitney R1830 twin Wasp radials, producing 1,000 horsepower each.
And they were some great engines.
they kind of became the standard for bomber engines throughout the war. And I believe the early Corsairs had them as well.
I'm not sure if it was the 1830. I would have to look that up.
So the 1830 or the 2400 they had? I think it was the 2400.
Okay.
Very good engines.
Yes.
So the B-24's maximum takeoff weight was one of the highest of the period, giving it a greater payload potential than other bombers of the time. The new design was also the first American heavy bomber in production to use tricycle landing gear, a feature first introduced on the North American B-25 Mitchell's predecessor, the NA-40. Refer back to that episode. In January 1939, the Model 32 featured long, thin wings with the efficient Davis high aspect ratio design, also used on the projected Model 31 commercial flying boat, which promised improved fuel efficiency. Wind tunnel testing and extensive experimental programs using the Model 31 provided crucial data on the flight characteristics of the Davis airfoil, contributing to the bomber's design success. Early orders for the B-24 came before the XB-24 prototype had even flown. The U.S. Army Air Corps placed an order for 36 aircraft, and the French Air Force and Royal Air Force followed with orders for 120 and 164 bombers, respectively. The RAF initially dubbed the aircraft Liberator, a name later adopted by the US Air Force as the official designation for the Model 24. When France fell in 1940, its order was redirected to the RAF, further increasing demand for the aircraft and resulting in a backlog of orders. This shift led to a production backlog valued at $680 million, of which $400 million came from foreign orders.
Wow. Basically,
that thing was a moneymaker.
Hell yeah.
The increased demand and associated expansion of tooling and plant capacity helped accelerate U.S. aircraft production, bringing the anticipated volume forward up by up to a year. The British also influenced the design, requesting modifications to suit their needs, such as the B-24's large bomb bay and ability to carry 8,000-pound ordnance, which became a key feature of the aircraft's design. However, the XB-24 prototype was not without issues. Initial testing revealed several deficiencies, most notably its inability to meet the required top speed of 311 miles per hour. The prototype's maximum speed reached only 273 miles an hour, prompting a series of design changes. The mechanically supercharged Pratt & Whitney R1830-33 engines were replaced with turbo supercharged versions to improve performance. Additionally, the tail span was widened by 2 feet, and the pitot-static probes originally mounted on the wings were relocated to the fuselage for better aerodynamic performance. These adjustments led to the redesign of the XB-24 as the XB-24B, and the changes became standard on all subsequent B-24s, starting with the B-24C model. In April 1939, the USAAC ordered 7 YB-24s under CAC contract number 12464. US policy allowed Allied orders to take precedence, enabling early evaluation in Europe. The first 6 YB-24s were released for purchase on November 9, 1940, and redesignated as LB-30As. The 7th aircraft was used for testing armor and self-sealing fuel tanks. Originally assigned serial numbers 39-681 to 39-687, the purchase was postponed twice, and the serial numbers changed to 40-696 to 40-702. When the RAF bought the first 6 YB-24s, their serials were redesignated to an early B-24D batch funded by the US deferment. The design. Yeah. Have I gone back? Oh, no, sorry. This is a design part 2. Should have really put that on the lady. Just confused myself right then. So, the B-24 featured a high aspect ratio Davis wing, as we talked about before, provided efficient lift, enabling high speeds and long range. While the wing had a 6-foot larger wingspan than the B-17, its lower wing area resulted in a 35% higher wing loading. The thick wing promised increased fuel capacity and lift, but it became difficult to handle under heavy loads, especially at high altitudes and in poor weather. The Davis wing also had issues with ice formation, leading to reduced lift and flight instability. It was more prone to damage than the B-17's wing, making the B-24 less resilient to battle damage. That's probably the one thing the B-17 has over the B-24. The B-17 could take up a loss of punishment.
Oh, yeah. You could destroy, what, most of the tail and still come back?
Which they did a lot. Mm-hmm. The B-24 was powered by 4 Pratt & Whitney R1830-35 Twin Wasp engines mounted in PBY Catalina-style cowlings. These engines drove 3-bladed variable pitch propellers. The aircraft's tail featured 2 large oval vertical stabilizers attached to rectangular horizontal stabilizers. While it was initially thought that a single fin would improve stability, all B-24s were produced with twin fins, except for 8 pre-production B-24Ns, which were planned to feature a single tail, which we'll see later, and they look very weird.
I bet.
Due to the war's end, over 5,000 orders for the B-24N were cancelled, although the single fin was later used on the PB-4Y privateer. The B-24's spacious fuselage, nicknamed the Flying Boxcar, housed 2 central bomb bays capable of carrying up to 8,000 pounds of ordnance in each. However, this weight often reduced the aircraft's range and altitude. The bomb bays were featured unique tambour panel doors that minimize drag, allowing the bays to open while on the ground. Crew members often had to move along a narrow catwalk between the bomb bays, which could be cumbersome. The Liberator's crew could total up to 10. The pilot and co-pilot sat side by side in well-glazed cockpit. The navigator and bombardier were positioned in the nose, which featured a greenhouse design with multiple glazed panels and gun mounts. Later models had a powered twin 50 cal nose turret. The radio operator and flight engineer sat behind the pilots, with the engineer also operating the upper turret. The aircraft also had a retractable ball turret and waist guns, along with a tail gun turret. The waist gun hatches had doors for ease of access. The B-24 featured a tricycle undercarriage, the first of its kind in American bomber. While this allowed for better ground handling, the aircraft's use of differential braking and thrust made taxiing a challenge. So, now we're getting on to their variants. So, for the US Army Air Force variants, Part 1, we have the XB-24, which is, of course, as we've noticed, as we've seen, is the prototype, as well as the YB-24 and LB-30As, which are the top two you can see right here. Those are the two prototypes.
Okay.
So, by the time you get down to the production, you have the B-24A or the LB-30B. So, ordered in 1939, this was the first production model. Due to a demand for long-range aircraft, it was ordered before any B-24 version had flown. Aerodynamic improvements over the XB-24 enhanced its performance. 9 B-24As were built as transports and transferred to Ferrying Command, while 20 were sold to the UK prior to the Lend-Lease as LB-30s. And that is what we see here. Unarmed, totally for transport, but still looking pretty damn good. Part 2. We have the Liberator B Mark II, or the LB-30. So this is even before the Americans started using them. The British were, and so I've just put this one in the US ones. You'll notice a few key differences for the British one, mainly their the armament that we'll talk about in a little bit. But just look at this one versus the others, and you'll start to notice there's a couple of differences. So
the top turrets move far back, isn't it?
Yep. And how many guns has the top turret got now?
Is that just one?
Nope.
I really can't tell from that picture. It's a little too small. At least on my screen it is.
It's got 4.
Really?
So, the first combat-ready B-24, the B Mark II, or the LB-30, featured several modifications, including a 3-foot nose extension, deeper rear fuselage, wider tailplane, self-sealing fuel tanks, and added armor. Built to British specifications with British equipment, it had no direct B-24 counterpart but was similar to the B-24C. Except for the first aircraft, which was used as a prototype and lost as a test flight, the remaining models were delivered unarmed. The British added their own armament after arrival. Following the US entry into the war in December 1941, 75 of these aircraft were requisitioned by the USAAF, retaining the LB-30 designation. These were delivered unarmed, but later fitted with Browning M2 50 cals in the nose, waist turrets ventral, and twin manual mount in the tail. Additionally, a Martin turret replaced the British Bolton Pool dorsal turret. Some were sent to the Southwest Pacific, Alaska, and Midway Island, whilst others were later returned to the UK. In 1943, 17 were fitted with ASV radar for use in the Panama Canal Zone. A total of 165 were produced. So instead of having twin 50s and mounted closer to the cockpit, it was more essential, and it had the turret from Bolton Pool Defiance, which had 4 303s in them.
Okay.
So a model of that, this particular model would be quite cool to have.
Yeah, it would.
Definitely make it stand out a bit. Up next, the XB-24B was a modified version of the XB-24 after it failed to meet its top speed requirements. The Pratt & Whitney R1830-33 engines were replaced with R1830-41 turbo supercharged radials, increasing the top speed by 37 miles an hour. The engine cowlings were redesigned to accommodate the turbo superchargers, and the engine slots were removed. The XB-24B was reserialed, with one unit converted into a luxury airliner for Concierway. Never heard of that before, which involved a complete interior overhaul with new windows, compartments, individual and bench seating, Pullman-style sleeping bear, soundproofing, and galley. One of these was converted, which you can see right here. Wouldn't mind having that as a personal transport.
Oh, yeah?
The B-24C was a new production model funded by deferred US funds after the LB-30A order for the UK. It incorporated the engine package tested in the XB-24B and fuselage design of the LB-30. The tail gunner position was improved with a hydraulically powered A6 turret featuring twin 50 cals. A Martin-powered dorsal turret was added to the forward fuselage. One B-24C was converted to prototype the 3-in-nose armament for the B-24D. Serial numbers and funding were transferred from the B-24A. A total of 9 were built. Part 3. In the part 3, we have the D, E, F, G, and G1. The two main ones we have are the D and the E. First up, the B-24D was the first model to enter large-scale production, ordered from 1940 to 1942. It was based on the B-24C, but featured more powerful radial R1830-43 supercharged engines. Initially, the B-24D was equipped with a remote-operated Bendix belly turret, similar to those on the B-17E Flying Fortresses and the B-25 Mitchell Bombers. However, this system proved unsatisfactory and discontinued after the 287th aircraft, primarily because when you tried to use it, most crews ended up being horribly airsick.
Oh, I imagine.
Yeah, you're trying to look down the periscope and underneath periscope, looking down whilst in a moving aircraft, and you'll just be thrown up everywhere.
I could imagine.
Later models reverted to a manually operated tunnel mounting a single 50 cal machine gun, which was eventually replaced by the Sperry ball turret adopted from B-17E. The ball turret was made retractable for the B-24D due to the aircraft's low fuselage height. Late production B-24s also featured cheek guns mounted either side of the nose, just behind the greenhouse cockpit. Total 2,696 units were built, 2,381 were built by Consolidated in San Diego, 305 by Consolidated in Fort Worth, and 10 by Douglas and Tunisia, Oklahoma. Tulsa.
It's a wrong continent.
Yeah, whatever. They ended up in Tunisia, I can tell you that.
Yeah, a few did, yeah.
Yeah. Some of them are probably still there. The B-24E, a slight variation of the D, the E was built by Ford and used R1830-65 engines. It retained the belly tunnel gun and was primarily used by the USAAF as a trainer. The aircraft produced and consolidated in San Diego were similar to the Ford-built B-24Es, but featured R1830-43 radials, the same as the B-24D. Ford also produced sub-assemblies known as KD or knockdown kits for Douglas and Convair Fort Worth, which were transported to the Southwest for final assembly. A total of 801 were built. The XB-24F was a prototype D variant converted to test thermal de-icers intended to replace the standard inflatable rubber boots. Only one was converted. The G was a version of the D variant built by North American Aviation under a 1942 contract, equipped with a Sperry ball turret and 3 flexible 50 cals in the nose. A total of 25 were built. And the G1, similar to the G, but with an A6 nose turret. Most B-24 G1s were operated by the 15th Air Force in Italy. A total of 405 were built. We can finally start talking about a few models, because most companies don't have a kit. The earliest kit they have is of the D variant, as we can see right here. So if you want to build, say, a B-24D, you have a lot of options. First up, you have Edard, Ravel, if you hate yourself, but that's in 48 scale. Airfix have their D variant of the Liberator, which is supposed to be quite a good kit. Hasegawa as well. Academy, although that's their weird... That one's under that weird sort of academy name. It's a bit of an older one. Don't know if you want to go for it. And, of course, you have the Hobby Boss B-24D Liberator in 32nd scale with a full interior, which I would love to have, I gotta say.
Hell yeah.
So if you want to build G variants, F variants, anything like that, the D is the best way you're going to go for it. You're just going to have to do a bit of modification and scratch building to do anything like that. Because, yeah, a lot of the lesser known variants of the Liberator aren't covered that much, that well with model kits. I would say if you want to go 72nd, go with Airfix or Eddard. 48, don't bother. 32nd, yeah, probably covered. And for the part four, we have the HJ, K, and L. So the H, to address the vulnerability of the B-24 in head-on attacks, this is the first time they got the nose turret. The B-24 featured an electrically powered Emerson A-15 nose turret above the bombardier's position, similar to the Fraser-Nash FN-5 turret in the Avro Lancaster. Around 50 other airframe modifications were made, including a redesigned bombardier compartment. The tail turret received larger windows for improved visibility, and the Martin A3 dorsal turret was upgraded with a larger high hat dome. The waist gunner's position were enclosed with plexiglass and offset laterally to minimize interference between gunners. They didn't want them to be butt to butt. I think some of them were enjoying it too much. Most B-24H aircraft were built by Ford at Willow Run. Total of 3,100 of these were built. There's also a very good documentary about Willow Run on YouTube. I highly recommend people find that.
I'll look that up.
Oh, it shows just how fast they can produce. They were producing Liberators. It was something like one a day was coming out of the factory.
Damn.
Yeah. And basically, it's all set up, so they're basically just giant kit sets as well, which is like, you know, that pleases me on a level. The B-24J was similar to the B-24H, but due to a shortage of Emerson nose turrets, the B-24J aircraft built at Consolidated San Diego and Fort Worth factories were equipped with a modified, hydraulically powered Consolidated A6 turret. The J also featured an improved C-1 autopilot and M-1 bombsight. Any B-24H sub-assemblies built by Ford and later retrofitted with the C-1 or M-1 were designated B-24Js. This is the only B-24 variant built at all five production facilities, with a grand total of 6,678 of these built.
Wow.
So you can see here we've got an H and a J, and you can just see there's a difference in the nose turret.
Slight difference.
Yeah. Just enough. Okay, the K. This is one of the weird ones. The XB-24K developed from the B-24ST. The XB-24K featured a single turret, single tail and rudder, replacing the standard Liberator's twin tail. The improved performance and handling of both the B-24ST and the XB-24K led to the decision to incorporate a single tail into later variants like the PB-4Y and B-24N. Only one of these were converted from a B-24D into a K. And you can see, looks a little
that
weird.
That looks pretty good, though.
It looks like the privateer, so, you know.
Yeah, it does.
I prefer the twin tail, though.
Oh, but, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It's iconic to the aircraft.
Yeah, yeah. It's what makes a Liberator a Liberator. And lastly, we have the B-24L. To address the excessive weight of the J, the Army requested a lighter version. In the B-24L, the Sperry ball turret was replaced with a floor ring mount for two 50 cal machine guns, and the A-6B tail turret was swapped for an M-60A. Later models were delivered without tail guns, with turrets installed at depots before reaching operational units. The L model was built at Willow Run and Consolidated San Diego factory. A total of 1,667 of these were built. I desperately wanted to try and find a photo of an L showing the underside with the ring-mounted twin 50s, but this is the best I could get. Mm. So, yeah, I really wanted to see how it would look, because that would be interesting. You know, literally upside-down ring mount.
Yeah.
You definitely want to make sure you're strapped down, because you just have this giant hole right in front of you.
Yeah, essentially you would.
And for part four, for models. Your options, well, from left to right, you have Hasegawa, the B-24J, Liberator 90BG, the Jolly Rogers. From Academy, you have the B-24H Liberator Zodiac. Hobby Boss and 32nd, you have the B-24J Liberator, full interior and all of that. Of course, you have the Academy old school boxing, the B-24J. And, of course, you have the brand new, up-to-date Airfix consolidated B-24H Liberator, full interior, 72nd scale. I've seen a guy on YouTube build this up. It looks absolutely amazing. Really want it. Okay, so part five, the B-24M was an improved version of the B-24L with further weight reductions. It featured a lighter A6B tail turret, open waist gunner positions, and reintroduced the retractable Sperry ventral ball turret. From Block 20 onward, Ford-built aircraft had a new less-framed windshield for improved visibility from the flight deck. The B-24M was the final production model of the B-24, though many were flown straight from the factory to the scrapyard, which is that's sad.
Yeah.
A total of 2,593 were built. Now we're getting into the weird ones. And I love the weird ones.
I'd say the fun ones.
Oh yeah, these are the really interesting ones. First off, we have the XB-24N, a redesign of the J. The XB-24N featured a single tail and an Emerson 128 ball turret in the nose, along with a stationary tail gunner's position. Though 5,168 Ns were ordered, all contracts were cancelled before production began due to the war's end. The single tail design was later influenced the PB-4Y privateer. Only one was built. This thing looks like a B-26 Marauder on steroids.
Yeah, but I can see it.
Yeah, it's got that sort of like look to it. I mean, it definitely looks prototype though.
Oh yeah.
We have up next the YB-24N, which is just a pre-production service test version of the XB-24N. We have the XB-24P, a modified D variant used by Sperry Gyroscope Company to test airborne fire control systems. The XB-24Q was converted from the B-24L. The XB-24Q was used by General Electric to test a radar-controlled tail turret designed for the Boeing B-47 Stratojet, which is this one here. Looks very weird.
That's odd, yeah.
The XB-41 was developed as a gunship escort for bombers, similar to what they tried with the B-17. Mm-hmm. Following a lack of fighter escorts on deep missions, armed with 14 50-cal machine guns, including a Bendix Chinn turret and a second Martin A3 turret, it was based on the B-24D. Performance suffered significantly with the additional armament, no shit, and the project was cancelled in 1943 after testing showed it couldn't keep up with bomber formations, and even then, it was still a pretty big target.
Yeah.
Looks awesome, though.
It does, yes.
And finally, we have the B-24ST, which stands for Single Tail, was an experimental aircraft built by Ford, featuring a single tail and rudder on the B-24. Demonstrated improved stability and handling, and its design served the basis for the XB-24K. Of course, that all went really nowhere. And the only models from this lot is one from Academy and one from Minicraft. So if you really hate yourself, but you really want a B-24M, both in 72nd scale. Yeah. If you hate yourself. Of course, there are a whole bunch of support Liberator variants. These are all ones that have been converted into various prototypes. So I won't go through the whole list here, but I'll just pick out a few notables, like the RB-24L, which is a converted B-24L for training B-29 gunners on a remote gun system. So it's just built up so they could train using that. There's a whole bunch for testing out new radars and just testing out new stuff. We have the C-87 Liberator Express, a transport version of the B-24, accommodating up to 20 passengers. We have the XC-109 or the C-109 fuel tankers were used to transport fuel from India to China, supporting early B-29 raids against Japan. We have the XF-7, a photo reconnaissance variant developed from the B-24D. And lastly, I think the one that's most interesting, the BQ-8. Converted B-24D and J aircraft uses radio-controlled flying bombs targeting German positions. Notably, Joseph P. Kennedy Jr. was killed during Operation Anvil in a BQ-8. The whole point of the BQ-8s, and we need to do an episode on UAV and remote bombs and all of that.
Oh, definitely.
The whole point was they would line them up, and then the pilots would bail out. Turns out he didn't bail out. Or got caught up in it. So, you know, it detonated and he didn't survive, basically. Mm. Interesting story. Of course, we have the US Navy sub variants as well, like the PB4Y1, which is the US Navy's designation for 976 navalized B-24D, J, L, and M models. Later models were equipped with an ERCO nose turret. The PB4Y1P was a photo reconnaissance variant. The PB4Y2 Privateer, an enhanced version of the PB4Y1, featuring a larger single tail fin, a lengthened fuselage, and several other improvements. The P5Y was a proposed twin-engine patrol version, which was never built. The RY1 was their designation for the transport variant, as well as the RY2 and 3. And the R2Y was a Liberator liner built with a new fuselage for the U.S. Navy, designed as an airliner with 48 seats.
That's crazy looking.
And we have some models for those sub-variants. So we have the Revel Privateer, a very sought-out model kit. This is actually a Reebok Matchbox kit. But it looks like it's I've heard multiple things. It's supposedly a not the best kit, but it's the only one you could get of the Privateer, hence why it's very sought out, because the Privateer is a cool aircraft. Other than that, you have from Academy the PB4Y1 US Navy Liberator, and the Revel also do the PB4Y1. Here you have two different variants. The Academy has the ball turret in the nose. The Revel one has the glazed nose.
Very nice.
So if you want to make the Navy version, you have Academy or Revel. Good luck. British and Commonwealth sub-variants, part one. There's not as many of this one, so we'll get through them fairly quickly. First off, we have this Liberator C Mark I. RAF direct purchase of the YB-24 aircraft. These were deemed unsuitable for combat and were converted into transports. These were used by BOAC for flights between the UK and Canada, including ferrying air crews for Lend-Lease aircraft transfers. A total of 9 were built. Also, hot take. Uh-huh. Liberators in RAF and Coastal Command colours look better than American colours. I'm just going to put it out there.
I'll agree to an extent. The Coastal Command, yes.
To be honest, Coastal Command, just whole color scheme for aircraft, just like hits hard.
It does.
It just looks cool. Be a bitch to keep clean, but it looks cool. It's also a bitch to paint. The Liberator B Mark I was a direct purchase of the B-24As. Similar to the C Mark I, these were unsuitable for combat and later repurposed for other roles. We have the Liberator GR Mark I. Just going to say here, when you see GR versus B, GR is for general reconnaissance and anti-submarine patrols. B is for bomber. So that's how they also show the difference between the roles that they were using them in.
Makes sense.
Yep. So the Mark I model was modified for general reconnaissance and anti-submarine patrol. It was equipped with a belly pan. Panner housing 4 fixed forward-firing 20mm Hispano cannons, ASV radar undoing Yagi Uda antenna, and 4 large antenna masts on the fuselage. Fucking, I'd love to see the 4 20mm underneath.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine doing a head-on attack and suddenly you got four 20 mils shooting? It's like, oh, I regret things. the Liberator B Mark II, based on the LB-30. This was the first combat-ready Liberator. Modifications included a 3-foot nose extension, deeper fuselage, wider tailplane, self-sealing fuel tanks, and added armor. God, I sound like I'm doing a fucking sales speech right here. Built to British specifications, it featured British equipment and Bolton-pulled turrets, with a top turret relocated further back along the fuselage. Da-da-da. Already spoken about that, but I just needed to include it within this one again. Looks very cool.
It does.
Part 2, we have the Liberator C Mark II. The Mark II was a transport variant, with some B Mark IIs converted for this role, including one that became the personal transport of British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, named Commando. This aircraft was later extensively upgraded to the C Mark IX standard, featuring a single tail fin, which is this one right here. That is Commando.
Nice.
Very cool. Liberator B Mark III was the B-24D variant. The Mark III featured a nose-mounted 303s, Browning machine guns, two additional guns in each waist position, and four more in a Bolton-pulled tail turret, similar to the one used in the Handley Page Halifax. The Martin dorsal turret was kept in place. A total of 156 of these units were built. Here you have actually a guy at my club built one of these in 32nd scale with all the as this variant. Looks so cool. I've got a photo. I'll need to send it to you guys.
Yeah, I'd love to see it.
The Liberator B Mark IIIA was a Mark III variant equipped with American-made equipment and weaponry. The Liberator GR Mark III was a Mark III modified for general reconnaissance and used by RAF Coastal Command in anti-submarine operations. It was equipped with radar, featuring the antennae, and a lead light for detecting submarines. Have you ever heard of the lead light?
No, I don't think I have.
Oh, you should... When you have a bit of spare time, search up the lead light and how it works. It literally made such an effect to anti-submarine at night that the Germans had to change their entire thing with, you know, usually they'd be leaving the Bay of Biscay surfaced at night. Mm-hmm. They couldn't do that anymore. That's how good it was. They had lost too many to that. So, yeah, that like literally just how good this system was. It was literally a light that could be fixed on a position as they were flying towards it.
Huh.
The mechanics behind it is really cool. Yeah, definitely look it up.
I will.
And the only model for this lot of sub-variants is the Liberator Mark III or V Coastal Command. This is by Hasegawa. Hasegawa, I think in 72nd, but I might be wrong. But here you can see you got the four guns in the turret in the top, four guns in the tail turret. You got the radar and all that. Very cool looking variant of the Liberator. We have part three of the British Commonwealth sub-variants. We have the Liberator B Mark IV, which was an unused designation set aside for the B-24E. We have the Liberator B Mark V, which is a modified B-24D. The Mark V featured increased fuel capacity but reduced armor. It was armed similarly to the Mark III. You have the Liberator GR Mark V, which was used, as we say, for general reconnaissance. As well as being equipped with radar and the lead light, some aircraft were fitted with 8 zero-length rocket launchers, 4 mounted on each wing, whilst others had stub wings on the forward on the lower forward fuselage to accommodate 8 RP-3 rocket rails. I could not find the fuselage-mounted rockets on there. That would look amazing.
That would look pretty wild.
I mean, having 8 rockets mounted on the fuselage, just I couldn't find a single photo. If anyone listening to this and knows how I can find a photo of that, please send it. I got to see that. The Liberator B Mark VI was an H variant, featured the nose turret, a Bolton Paul tail turret, and retained the rest of its armament. The GR Mark VI was the B-24G, H, and J variants used by RAF Coastal Command for anti-submarine patrols. Some aircraft had their top turrets removed during service, primarily because they didn't really need it. They were flying out and they were flying far enough that the German aircraft couldn't get to them, and just weight saving, basically. And of course, we have the Liberator C Mark VI, which is a converted into a cargo aircraft. And if you want to build any of these Commonwealth sub-variants, we have the Airfix B-24 Liberator B-6, and I believe that is RAAF scheme. Mm-hmm. We have the Eddard Riders in the Sky 1944, which is a Liberator GR Mark V. Very cool. And from Hasegawa, we have a B-24J Liberator Coastal Command.
I believe the Edward is just a reboxed Hasegawa.
Yeah, I think it is. And Hasegawa is a very hit or miss.
Yeah.
Okay, British Commonwealth Subvariants Part 4. We have the Liberator C Mark 7. Sorry.
Yep.
forgot how to read the Roman numerals just then. That is just the RAF version of the C-87 transport. The Liberator B Mark 8 was the RAF's B-24J. The GR Mark 8 was the RAF Coastal Command variant. Most notable, though, it had the top turret removed and belly turret was replaced with a semi-recessed radar dome. The Liberator C Mark 8 was just the aircraft, so C means cargo. Mm-hmm. So you got general reconnaissance, bomber, and then C is cargo for anyone trying to keep up with the British nomenclature. And we have the Liberator C Mark 9, which is the RAF's version of the C-87C transport with the single fin instead of twin fins.
Now, what was that last photo of? Because that is a very nice photograph, yeah.
That, I believe, that one is a GR Mark 8.
Okay.
I think.
I really like that one.
Yeah. It looks nice. It's the Coastal Command livery. it just goes hard.
It does.
Now, of course, this is the British and Commonwealth subvariants. However, there were a few countries that operated the Liberator in one form or another, and some of the countries might just surprise you. First off, if you want to make your Liberator a little bit more special out of everyone else, if you want to go full hipster, you can go with the Australian, the RAAF. They operated the Liberator. India, after the war, operated Liberators in the 50s for a short time. The Soviets operated about 24 Liberators during the war. Most of these were built out of spare parts. Like, they had multiple different crashed Liberators, and they just cobbled them together to make whole Liberators.
Yeah, it sounds just like Russia.
Yeah. We have one example. It was in Romanian colors. This was one that had been forced down and captured in Romania. So here we have a photo of it in its Romanian colors. That is a B-24D. A B-24D crash-landed in Turkey and was interned for the war and then used by the Turkish Air Force. of course, Turkey went, like, officially part of the war, so they just, like, interned anyone that turned up.
Yeah.
And they have one of theirs in Turkish colours. Second to last, we have a captured one from Italy. They captured one, used it for general transport uses. And you can see here with the big white crosses that the Italians like to use. And there is one that I could only find one photo, but it didn't show anything. And that was Nicaragua. They got a couple of B-24s for transport use. However, there was only one photo of that, and it was a front-on, so you couldn't see the liveries, which is a bit annoying because I really wanted to see what that would look like.
Hmm. It's not really a country you really think about.
Not really. Not really, no. I gotta say, making a Romanian one should be kind of cool. It would throw people off.
You're right.
And there are two other lesser known roles for the B-24. The first off are assembly ships or formation ships. In February 1944, the 2nd Division authorized the use of assembly ships or formation ships to help bomber groups organize their formations. Because it could take up, you know, those big bomber formations that they would send over? That could take up to an hour to actually get everyone in formation. Mm-hmm. So they needed formation ships so they knew which way they were going, which way they were all, you know, who to follow up on and who was leading, and then eventually they would disappear. They'll kind of get the formation going in the direction they need to, and then they'll just drop back. And they were usually piloted by crews that had been grounded for the mission, so they would take that up because, you know, they knew everyone. I love the fact that they went for these big, weird, flashy sort of liveries as well, so you could tell which one was the lead ship. I love the fact that they've put a star on the wheel hub on the front wheel as well. It's just so cool. There's so many different liveries that they went with. I think they kind of just went to the ground crews and just went, go nuts.
Just whatever you could think of.
Yeah. It's like, make it stand out. So these specifically modified aircraft, typically retired P-24s from the 44th, 93rd, and 389th groups, were equipped with signal lighting and pyrotechnic discharge systems. They were painted in high contrast patterns such as stripes, checkers, or polka dots, specific to each group for easy recognition. The planes had their armament and armor removed, and in some cases, the tail turret as well. For B-24Hs, the nose turret was replaced with a carpetbagger-type nose. Signal lighting was often consisted of white flashing lamps arranged to form the group's identification letter. To prevent flare gun accidents in the fuselage, some planes had pyrotechnic guns mounted on the sides. These aircraft, which returned to the base after the formation was established, typically carried a skeleton crew of two pilots, navigator, and a radio operator, and one or two flare operators. In some cases, an observer officer flew in the tail position to monitor formation. These planes became known as Judas Goats. And there is one other lesser-known Liberator variant, which is probably the most out there in sort of the realms of what the fuck. And that is the Consolidated LB-30, which was a civilian variant of the B-24 Liberator bomber used by Qantas in the 1940s for long-range passenger and cargo flights. These aircraft were converted from military bombers and played a significant role in trans-Pacific operations, particularly on routes between Australia and the United States. Known for their impressive range and reliability, the LB-30s were capable of carrying both passengers and cargo over extended distances. They became an essential part of Qantas's operations during and after World War II, helping establish vital air links between Australia and international destinations. The LB-30 also contributed to the expansion of global air travel, marking a key development in the growth of commercial aviation in the mid-20th century. So here we have a civilian B-24 in Qantas markings, and you can build both of them. From Hasegawa, you have a B-24J Liberator assembly ship and a B-24D formatting monitor, is what they call it. Both the J comes with green and yellow stripes. The D comes bright yellow with red polka dots and looks incredible, to be honest.
Kind of looks like it would be Italian.
Yeah, a little bit. And from Hawkeye Models, the Consolidated LB-30 Liberator Qantas Heritage Series. I think this is a resin kit or a vacuform or not one that you'd want to deal with. However, it is the modified Liberator with the Qantas livery on it if you want it. And that is it. That is us for the Liberator. Of course, this is going to be a short episode, so we're going to forego the works in progress, hobby news, and all of that. That will be in the next episode, just because we've been desperately trying to get an episode out for you guys, and we just haven't, and we've finally managed to get an hour for it, so we're just fucking going with it.
Yeah, so see you guys in another 2 months.
Yeah, 2 months, 3 months, you know, whenever we can get round to it at this bloody rate. However, we have come to the end of our episode, which means, of course, we have to thank our Patreon supporters. That is our Pinju supporters of Paul Gallagher, Lord Floki, Robert Judson, Raleigh Masteroni, and Liam Barnett, as well as our Pinju follower, Robert Brisbane. You guys are amazing. You help support and keep the lights on around here and keep our costs down. So, that was the B-24 Liberator. We do apologize for the shorter than usual episode, but we're just trying to make things work. So,
it was very informative.
Yeah, It was. And I think I needed the practice as well for my voice, you know. It's been a while. I got to keep it going.
Oh yeah.
But all that leaves is for me to say, if you have been watching and listening this far, thank you for listening to the Micro Machines podcast. We thank you from the bottom of our hearts for supporting us, and we will see you in the next episode. Bye for now.